vous propose de commencer ce troisième cours de Rob Phillips. Rob Phillips.
Wow. Quel accent, c'est glorieux.
Qui poursuit donc le cours qu'il a commencé à donner il y a maintenant 15 jours. Et merci d'être là. Donc aujourd'hui, le sujet du cours, c'est Life as Defiance, qui est très mystérieux, mais vous allez vite voir. Donc après l'allostérie et The Concept of Sameness la dernière fois, maintenant nous poursuivons notre parcours avec Rob Phillips. Merci beaucoup d'être avec nous. We can't wait.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's great to see all of you here. And thanks so much for coming. And let me just say again, it's a huge privilege and pleasure to be here among friends and about new friends and just to be a part of this great institution. So I'm going to continue, as Thomas said, with my theme, Biology by the Numbers. And you might remember that I had four themes that I wanted to pursue. So, they're the most important part of what I want to say, is the themes. The specifics are something that if you want to pursue on your own after, feel free, but it's more the sort of philosophical threads that I think are the most important. So on the first day I told you about what sets the scale of X, that's my own proposition for what it means to understand a thing. And then last week we talked about sameness, and today I want to talk about life as defiance, and you'll see what I mean by that as I go. So I have three basic ideas that I want to get across. So the first part has to do with, in a way, a kind of silly question. You know, it's kind of like asking, who's the greatest soccer player ever? Or, you know, what's the best food or something like that? So what's the secret of life? It's a little silly. But at the same time, it's also kind of amusing. So I'll spend maybe 10 minutes on that. And then I want to talk about biological batteries. And I hope that for many of you, this will be kind of a different spin on what makes biological systems tick. And then in the end, I'm going to give two different case studies having to do with the way that by using biological batteries, biological systems can do things that an equilibrium system cannot. So that's the plan of action. So I want to start out with this notion of the secret of life. And so there's this interesting article that you can check out. You'll remember last week that I talked about allostery. It's really important for me to tell you all that it's fun that Jean-Pierre Changeux is here. And whether or not this quote is true or not doesn't matter. I'm trying to make a point. Okay, I don't care about the specifics of Monod. I just want to make a point. So the claim was that, you know, after thinking about allostery, that there was some reference to this as the second secret of life. And last week I told you that there was a quantitative way to think about allostery that I think is quite remarkable, having to do with the so-called MWC model. But it does raise the question, and that is, if allostery is supposedly the second secret of life, then what is the first secret of life? And I think, you know, if I had more time, it would be fun to do a sondage with all of you about what you think the first secret of life might be. You know, obviously, in the hands of Watson and Crick, as you can see here, on 28 February, Mr. Crick walked into a Cambridge pub with Mr. Watson to celebrate the fact that they had unraveled the structure of DNA, saying, "We have discovered the secret of life." And so, you know, that's amusing. I certainly acknowledge that figuring out how genes work was really, really wild and important. But it does raise the question, what are some of the other contenders? So there's this very nice article and a corresponding book and a lecture that's given by Paul Nurse, in which he tries to address what are the great ideas of biology. And his contenders are the cell as the basic structural and functional unit of life, the gene is the mechanism of heredity, evolution by natural selection, and life is chemistry. And then he adds a fifth idea is explored, whereby biological organization is explained in terms of logical and informational processes and structures. So, you know, this notion of the secret of life, again, this could be hyperbole, it could be a way of doing marketing. I don't really know, but again, I think it's also kind of fun. I like asking people, what are your favorite books? We're never going to settle the question of, is Pride and Prejudice the greatest book? You know, I've asked 1,500 people to tell me their favorite books. The all-time winner is Pride and Prejudice. What can I tell you? And the number two is Dostoevsky. And just as an aside, almost never does a person tell me both. So I find that amusing. I start judging people. Are they a Pride and Prejudice person or a Dostoevsky person? Anyway, so there are courses. This is Eric Lander at MIT. And then probably many of you know about this article, which I just reread yesterday by Dobzhansky, which has this great title, Nothing in Biology Makes Sense Except in the Light of Evolution. And I think, you know, if somebody were to ask me, when I teach freshman biology at Caltech, I personally, if I had to choose one thing to say is the thing that students, and these are generally students that are not excited about biology, that I would want to tell them, it would not be the structure of DNA or the molecular interpretation, it would be evolution. That would be my first choice. So I think it's also fun. Again, this is all just by way of introduction and also just to entertain you a little bit. Gerhard and Kirshner wrote a very nice book called Cells, Embryos, and Evolution. And in the preface, they say, today, Dobzhansky might be tempted to say nothing in evolution makes sense except in the light of cell biology. I think that's an amusing twist on the Dobzhansky quote. And so what I want to do today is I want to depart from all of those ideas and instead offer my own version, or our own version, of the secret of life, which I'm going to refer to as defiance. And I'll explain what I mean by that as I go along, but for the moment, what I want to say is that there are many examples in biological systems where if you played the movie of their time evolution and you played it backwards, you would think there's something wrong with that. I think, I can't remember, but maybe on the first day I told you the sad biography of a certain egg. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty took a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. It's a very sad biography and very short. Here's the point. If I played the movie of Humpty Dumpty backwards, you would say, that's not the way the world works. But in fact, there are examples where if you play the movie and you just look at, for example, the ions in a cell, you'd say, oh, the ions are moving the wrong direction. They're going up their concentration gradient, for example. Or if we were to look at translation, as I will say later in the talk, you would actually conclude that the rate of errors in the translation of proteins, in the replication of DNA, is way off of what you would expect from equilibrium recognition of bonding. The third example I show in the upper right, adaptation to environmental change, is another extremely interesting example of defiance. And what I mean by that is that, in general, when we have an input-output curve, it has a sweet spot, which is sort of in the middle of the curve. In other words, at the midpoint between what I called leakiness last week and saturation. And in general, if I have a typical molecule, that midpoint doesn't change. It doesn't move if I change the circumstances of the system. But it turns out in lots of examples, including our eyes, but also bacterial chemotaxis and many others, the system will adapt itself. And that also requires paying energy. The one at the lower left, I think, is very important. And what I'm showing you there is the kind of kinetics that my book co-author Julie Theriault refers to as socks before shoes kinetics. And I guess I just want to point out that the notion here is that, in a certain sense, one-way arrows, although people are very fond of drawing biological cartoons with one-way arrows, they're really forbidden. There's a relationship that tells you to have a one-way arrow, you basically have to have infinite energy input into the system. And so when I speak of socks before shoes, I mean, I'm actually quite tempted to do a little experiment with you. What I'm talking about, I guess I will. I don't know if it's very kosher, but that's a shoe. That's a sock. Hopefully it doesn't smell too bad. That's a foot. And the thing is in equilibrium, there will be an equilibrium concentration of sock-shoe dimers, of shoe-foot dimers, I forgot which one I missed already, but the third one. There will be some trimers, and there'll also be a bunch of monomers. If I want to actually do this process, socks before shoes, then that one-way arrow requires an expenditure of energy. Why do I show you a picture of a bacteriophage? Because it's very interesting how they self-assemble. The capsid assembles by itself. The DNA gets packed inside of it. The tail assembles separately. And only when the two of them have assembled do they come together to form the full virus. So it's really a directed assembly process. Anyway, I'm not going to finish with these examples, but what I want you to note is that these different processes require the expenditure of energy. That's the main thing I wanted to say. So the bottom line is that what I'm going to tell you about is the six of us that have been working on this book, Physical Biology of the Cell, we've been having fun with this idea of playing with the secret of life is defiance. And I'm going to elaborate on that. So what do I mean by this? Let's dive into that a little bit. So the first thing I want to do is I just want to talk about the direction of natural processes. And I'm going to use an extremely artificial, but at the same time, very powerful example. And I would say often, you know, it took me years and years and years being both slow and poorly educated to kind of catch on to the idea that abstraction, simplification, idealization are actually very sophisticated. I think I mentioned, you know, when people told me about masses and springs without friction and all that stuff, I was like, massless spring and no friction. I felt like, wow, I feel like this is a contrived world. It takes a lot of sophistication to see that those simple examples actually shed light on very important things. So here's what I want you to imagine. I have this big box, and the box is separated from the world by walls that are simultaneously rigid, adiabatic, and impermeable. Rigid means I can't push or squeeze. Adiabatic means I can't take a flamethrower and heat up the inside. It's isolated thermally. And impermeable means that I cannot exchange molecules. The number of molecules in there is fixed. And the thing that I want to say is that we can actually think about the direction of spontaneous processes when we remove a constraint. And when I say remove a constraint, let's take the middle example. If I have the brakes on, and now I remove the brakes, that wall is going to move until the pressure on the two sides is equal. But a way of thinking of that, actually, is that the system evolves so that it has a state of what's called maximum entropy. And that's really the idea that's behind things. So I can't remember if I showed this. I've talked too many times in the last 6 weeks. It's probably a good sign that I need to shut up. But let me say that I think many people would say that the greatest American-born scientist in history is Josiah Willard Gibbs. That's him. He was an unpaid professor at Yale University. Just imagine that. And so he wrote this quite amazing article called On the Equilibrium of Heterogeneous Substances. You can see it was published in the Transactions of the Connecticut Academy of Sciences, you know, completely obscure kind of journal. In this era of impacts and all that, it's just important to note that somebody like Gibbs only wrote about 25 papers in his whole career. So his H index is lower than mine. I'll leave it to you to draw conclusions about what that means about the H index as opposed to what it means about me. But in this paper, what he did is he mathematicized this idea of how do you find the terminal privileged state of a system. And so just to elaborate on that, what he said is, he said if you want to find out where a system will go, it will evolve until it reaches a state of maximum entropy. And the entropy is a really cool and ultimately, in some sense, very simple idea that has to do with the number of ways that the system can be arranged. So let's take all of you in the chairs. Again, I think I maybe said this in the first week, but I don't remember. There are many ways for us to rearrange all of you in this room. And the number of ways of arranging all of you depends on how many of you are in the room. Let's do a thought experiment. Let's make everyone leave except Toma. Then the number of ways for Toma to be sitting in the room is equal to the number of chairs, because he can sit in this chair, this chair, this chair. And so there's n choices. But if I keep Jean-François and Thomas, now the number of ways of distributing them is larger. And it will keep going up until there's half filling, basically. So the number of ways of rearranging is in a way a measure of what this entropy concept is. And what Gibbs had to say is this. It almost seems like a tautology. If you set up a system in a state that's very, very sort of artificially unlikely, the system will evolve until it reaches the most likely state. So just for example, imagine that I put a partition in this room and I pump all the molecules of air to this side. And then I remove the partition. What will happen is the molecules will distribute over the whole room to a more likely state. And that's in a way what this entropy idea tries to discuss. So let me just point that out concretely. So what I'm showing you here is a plot of the entropy of this little system. And let me keep my eye on the prize. Why am I telling you this? Because this is our fate. If the system is left to its own devices, its fate is to maximize its entropy and reach a state of equilibrium. There was a famous exchange between a speaker, a physics speaker, and a biologist in the audience who at the end of the talk said to the physicist with scorn, "Napoleon is in equilibrium." I always laugh. Every time I fly into Paris, I just laugh because I see this Invalide over there and I just think to myself, yep, Napoleon's there in equilibrium. But the point is that the reason I want to talk about this is that biology finds a way to defy that call to equilibrium. So what's plotted here is the total entropy, shown in green, as a function of the position of the barrier. For this particular setup, the place where the pressure will be equal is when the partition is at the middle. And so you can see if we slide the partition in this direction, what will happen is we increase the entropy of the guys on the right, but we decrease the ones on the left. And there's some balance, there's some place at which the entropy is maximized, and that's when the thing is in the middle. Could do the same thing for particle exchange. So here we open up a hole in the little wall, and molecules are free to jiggle around back and forth. And in this case also, the entropy is maximized when the so-called chemical potential is the same on both sides. Okay, so what does that have to do with anything? Again, I'm trying to make the argument, if you don't understand the technical details, it doesn't matter. What I want you to take away from this is that these examples, in a way, defy that call to equilibrium in some sense, which I could be more precise about. Okay, so what's the mechanism of paying for this? So what I want to do is I want to spend a few minutes now talking about the notion of biological batteries. I want to try to give you an idea which has to do with exactly what I've done here. So somewhere in France is a power plant, and I don't know anything about it. And what I do is I show up from the US. I paid my appropriate $80, so I'd have this kind of plug as opposed to the one that I use at home. And then I show up here and watch. I don't think we're sufficiently impressed. Watch this. And I did it on an airplane today. Same thing. The way I like to say it is none of my business where that energy comes from. Okay, I realize that's a bit controversial in this particular day, but it's very interesting. We have these universal adapters. We plug in and we can run whatever we want. We can run a radio, we can run a computer, we can do a hair dryer. I don't know, you name it, you can use it. And so here it turns out that I'm showing you four different examples of biological batteries. So let's start with this column, the first column on the left. So far away, 150 million kilometers away, it's none of my business what's going on, but there's some nuclear reactions going on. Something's happening. That leads to a rain of photons. How many photons? 1,000 watts per square meter raining down upon us. And I'm going to just think of it as being a constant source that's just sitting there, bathing the Earth. Every one of those photons has an energy of about 100 kT. If you're not comfortable with those units, that's about 5 ATPs. Okay, that's the way I want you to think of it. 20 kT is 1 ATP. So a photon is worth about 100 kts. And out of that, that biological battery leads to the production, for example, of sugars. So they're shown here. The sugars have an amazing amount of energy associated with them. Let me just give you a sense of that. So if you burn a sugar molecule, it releases 2,800 kilojoules per mole. I'm not that much of a fan of those units, but if I convert that into KT units, it's around 1,200, or said differently, it's something on the order of, let's say, like 50 or 60 ATPs. It's a huge amount of energy. And this is just to amuse you for a second, it's quite fun to think about this. There's a ratio, basically, of 4/9, roughly 4/9, which tells you about the energy content of a sugar versus a fat. And here's a simple estimate of it. So if you take a fat, shown here, basically, there's for every carbon, there's two hydrogens, so that gives me a mass of 14. And the energy, I'm going to call it epsilon. Okay, so I have 20 of these bonds, 20 times 14, so this gives me the energy per mass. For glucose, I have 6 of these bonds, but there's 30 hydrogen masses. So if you compute both of these, you get a ratio of roughly 4/9. Okay, what's the point? The point is that there's a huge amount of energy stored in these sugar molecules. Huge. And that energy, for example, is used to set up, in some ways, the most elementary and important of the internal machines of the cell, which is a transmembrane potential, sometimes called the proton motive force. That, I think I have something to show you about that. So this proton motive force is very interesting. The idea is, the way I want you to think about any of these batteries is that all of them can be used to lift a weight. That to me is like my criterion of whether or not I understand a given battery. Can I find a way to make a contrivance to lift a weight? And so the transmembrane potential can be used to lift a weight. How? Well, there's two contributions. First of all, there's a voltage difference of around 100 millivolts across the membrane. If I move a charge across a potential, there's an energy, which is Q times the charge times that delta V. But also, when I move the particles across the membrane, I change the entropy. So both of these things contribute to a total energy budget that can be used to lift a weight. So to come back to this picture, what I'm telling you is that this delta G can be used, it runs from, say, few to 10 kBTs. It can be used to fuel all sorts of things, including the spinning of the little machines known as ATP synthase. As I just mentioned, I barely made it here today and had a beautiful flight this morning from Lisbon. And every time, Tomas can tell you that I've said this more times than probably he wants to hear, but every time we go out onto the runway, I always think to myself, the moment that the jet engines start their rumble for the takeoff roll, I always think to myself, wow, that is how fast the ATP synthase are spinning. It's amazing. 6,000 RPMs, 6,000 revolutions per minute, divide by 60 seconds, it gives you 100 hertz. That's how fast the jet engines are spinning. That's also how fast the ATP synthase is spinning. I don't know, you know, like I just don't know how to take that for granted. I don't know how to feel okay about that. Maybe all of you do, but I get weirded out. I say to myself, self, that's just too much. What do you think, Toma? Come on. Are you with me? Thank you. All right, well anyway, so these machines produce ATP, and then the ATP is the last of the batteries, and that one I think is also extremely interesting because the cell works very hard to maintain the ATP to ADP ratio. And just like, I won't unplug it, but I really want to, just like I can unplug and plug this thing in, or Tomas can walk up here, he can plug something in, that's the ATP to ADP ratio. It's just sitting there to be exploited by all sorts of different parasitic reactions. So I'll come back to that in a little bit. Okay, so that's my background to... I love it, yeah. So Jean-Francois' question was, he points out that the reaction actually involves ATP, ADP, and phosphate. And it turns out, actually, for some reactions, you go in one direction, it's ATP and ADP only, and then a phosphate on the way back. But you're absolutely right. If I write the equation for the delta G, in fact, there it is. Yeah, you can see that there's a phosphate in there. So just he's referring to the fact that up here I have logarithm ADP concentration, phosphate concentration over the ATP concentration, and also a standard state, which is usually not shown, but that's one molar and needs to be there. So indeed, the battery, to be more precise, the battery depends on all three of those concentrations, and they are kept in check, I would say. I know a little bit less about the phosphate part. Like the regulation of ATP and ADP is really tight. I would like to know more about that. And maybe it's something you and I could discuss. It's very interesting, I think. Okay, so with that, what I want to do now is I want to turn to two examples of the way that the biological battery can be used to maintain a system out of equilibrium. And I hope you'll be amused by these examples. So the first example I want to tell you about has to do with sugar uptake. And I remind you on the first lecture, I told you about the uptake of glucose, xylose, fructose, various carbon sources by cells, and that they have special transporters that sit in the membrane. The membrane is basically, for all practical purposes, impermeable to the sugars. And furthermore, they're going up a concentration gradient. Okay, so in order to get into the cell, they have to surf up their gradient. And the mechanism for that is a molecule, in the case of lactose, known as lactose permease. I'll come back to that in a second. So this is a slide I showed you on the first day. It's very busy, but let me just remind you what the idea was when I showed it. So first of all, in the upper left, the question I asked is how many carbons does it take to make a cell? Or alternatively, I could have asked how many sugars? It's the same question, basically. What I said was the mass of the cell is 30% dry mass. Half of that is carbon, basically. So 15% of the mass of the cell is carbon. And I can figure out what that is. It's 15 hundredths of a picogram per cell. And then I can figure out how many carbons or how many sugars that is, which is roughly, let's say, 10 to the ninth sugars that need to be taken up in 1,000 seconds. So that means a million sugars have to be taken on board every second. And what I was showing you here was the copy numbers, how many sugar transporters there are in a cell. This is the xylose transporter, this is the fructose, that's the glycerol, and this is the glucose transporter. Again, the details of this don't matter. All I want you to note is that the cell cares about its transporters. It sets up transporters to bring on carbon sources. And what I want to do is I want to try to think about how it is that one of these pumps works. So let me just make a plug for this very nice article, to my mind, really quite excellent article by Daniel Zuckerman, which you can find in the American Journal of Physics. It says, "Key biology you should have learned in physics class, using ideal gas mixtures to understand biomolecular machines." And you know, this is a good opportunity for me to maybe once again just comment that, you know, for me, I'm just very suspicious of the way that we, whether in France or the US, decide to teach 16-year-olds and 18-year-olds physics, math, chemistry, whatever. It was really funny today on the way from Orly. I had a really cool driver, and I always like talking to people. And so we talked about les maths and la physique. And he told me that he was highly traumatized as a kid by physics and math. And that's a very typical experience. So the reason I bring it up is I just think, you know, there could be so many fun ways to do physics for people that maybe aren't convinced that they like it, instead of starting with projectile motion, which, again, you've already seen. I'm a fan of that, but not necessarily for somebody that's not convinced that physics is interesting. So anyway, his question was, how can I understand the way one of these pumps works? So let me tell you what this schematic is intended to illustrate. So here is the membrane. This is outside of the cell. This is inside of the cell. I want you to notice that there's more sugar in than out. The blue molecules are the sugars. There's more ions on the outside, and this object is the permease. It's the molecule whose job it is to send the sugars up their concentration gradient. But note, at the same time that a sugar goes up its concentration gradient, an ion goes down its concentration gradient. And that's one of the most important things that I want to say to you, which is that there's coupling. It's an what I would call an AND gate. This molecule only works when ion and sugar are bound to it. If an ion comes by itself, it doesn't allow transport. If a sugar comes by itself, it does not allow transport. But if both come, it lets them both go across the membrane. And so what I want to do is just do a little bit of a dissection of how we might think about this from the standpoint of driving, from the standpoint of energy consumption, and from the standpoint of defiance. So the point I would try to make here is that this is a particular state of the system. What I'm showing you on this axis is the number of sugars on the inside, and this is for a particular choice. Let me just tell you what my choice was. We started out with all of the ions, 100% of the ions outside, zero on the inside, and half the sugar is in and half the sugar is out. It's a specific example just to make a story. Doesn't matter what my choices were, you could choose your own, but this is the particular case that I chose. And what's plotted on this axis is what I will call the driving force. It's how strongly the system is going to transport stuff. You can see that the driving force goes to zero at 75%. In other words, when 75% of the sugars are in and 25% are out, this thing runs out of driving force. There's no driving force. It will stop. So what I'm showing you here is the dynamics. This is a plot of the number of ions on the inside, the number of ions on the outside in red up on the top. The blue is the number of sugars outside and the number of sugars inside over time. And what you see is that over time, what happens is that the ions go into the cell, the sugars on the outside come into the cell, and at some point this thing stops because it has indeed reached its equilibrium. But that's not the way that the biology actually works. The biology is cooler than that. What actually happens is that every time one of these sugars gets transported, a pump sends the hydrogen back out again. Now that almost sounds like something for nothing. But let me tell you why it's not something for nothing. It costs about 20 kts of energy for the ion to be pumped back out. But the sugar is worth 1,000 or 1,200 kts. So let's check out my deal that I want to make with Professor Giovanni. Okay? Here's my question. For the rest of our lives, every day, you're going to deposit $20 in my bank account. Okay. But every day, I'm going to deposit $1,000 in your account. You in? See? So there, and I lose, right? I'm the loser in this game. He's a winner and I'm a loser. So the point is, sugar comes in. It's worth 1,000 kts worth of energy. 20 kts are used to pump the ion back out again to maintain the drive so that sugars can continually be pumped in. That's what's so incredibly cool and simple about this thing. It may be a little bit of a tangent, and maybe it's overly technical, but I guess I want to talk about it just because I'm hoping that maybe I'll get somebody aggravated enough that they'll want to pursue the point further. So back to this thing about Napoleon as an equilibrium. There's a whole polemic surrounding the question of, are we allowed to use equilibrium ideas when we talk about biology? And people are harsh, and they give very quick reactions. They just dismiss, just like that. Oh, you know, you can't use equilibrium ideas. So the thing I wanted to say about that, I just wanted to make a little side remark, which is, the rate at which sugars are transported across this thing is about 100 per second. But the rate at which these molecules are colliding with each other and jiggling around is something like 10 to the ninth, a billion collisions. There's a billion collisions of these sugars with each other in the time it takes one sugar to get transported across. To put that in perspective, it's like comparing the lifetime of a human to the time back to the Cambrian. Okay, in other words, you would not be offended if at the time scale of the Cambrian, I said, oh, well, there's this little 70-year period while a human being is wandering around having its pathetic little life. You know, that's nothing in the scheme of the Cambrian, 500 million years. And that's the comparison. So why do I say this? Because the system is jiggling around. The sugars are all, I'm going to say, equilibrating. And then every now and then, every very rarely, one molecule of sugar goes across the membrane. And then we wait another 500 million years. So it's just to say that this sort of equilibrium approach can be very useful, even in cases where ostensibly you're thinking about an out-of-equilibrium system. Pierre-Sens. Yeah, I mean, it would be fun for us to talk about it in more detail, but here's what I would say. It comes down to the fact that it's an AND gate. That molecule based. Well, okay, so let me show you something, and I'd love to talk about this further. If you don't mind, let me hunt for just a moment, Pierre.
I didn't want to slow you down.
No, it's all good. It's really fun to chat, so let's just see if I can figure out where it is. So Pierre's question was, he pointed out that the transporter, I'm going to say it in my words, the transporter has to be an AND gate. And for me, that's the crux of the whole thing, is that there has to be this coupling. If the coupling were more sloppy, then that would mean that you would have basically leakiness. And I like your question, because in a way you're saying, this is an example of the one-way arrow, right? And you're saying, dude, you got to be a little bit careful because the backward arrow is there as well. And that's why I wanted to show you this this notion of the AND gate. But this is a little weird because I always feel kind of funny about showing everybody my screen and stuff. But let's just do it quickly in the hope that I won't embarrass myself too much. Okay, so first, I really love this. This is a paper that was written by Andrew Mugler and Peter Ryan Tenwolde on logic gates. And what I want you all to notice on the top is that this is a two-input molecule. It has a concentration C1 of ligand number one and a concentration C2 of ligand number two. And what you can see is that for an AND gate, both C1 and C2 have to be high for you to get green, which is on, okay? For a NAND gate, which is really interesting, here you can't have C1 and C2 both high. That's the only case in which you don't get an output. And the point is, again, to Pierre's point, that you know you can get different versions of all of these kinds of outputs depending upon the makeup of your switch. So I'm not really answering your question. I know exactly what you're asking. It's a really good question, and it'd be fun for us to try to calculate, you know, what would be the cost or the leakiness? Because in a way, you're talking about the leakiness, right? And how much does it cost you to prevent it, right? I just want to make sure I'm on the right track. Yeah. So it's funny because it's very related to my next example, which is kinetic proofreading. So anyway, can we agree to talk about it further? I mean, it's really fun. Thanks for the question. Okay, so let me give you one last example, which has to do with kinetic proofreading. So probably many of you know that there are a variety of processes associated with what's called the central dogma of molecular biology. So DNA gets copied with a certain error rate, DNA gets transcribed with a certain error rate, and then mRNAs get turned into protein chains with a certain error rate. And I hope the sound is not on.
Using computer.
Oh boy. Let's see if I can figure out how to turn the sound off. Yeah, there we go. Okay. So So let me tell you about this really nice analogy made by Tanya Baker, all right? So what I want you to imagine is that the size of DNA, the DNA double helix, is a cylinder about this diameter. If that's the case, then the polymerase that copies the DNA is about the size of a FedEx truck. It's traveling at 500 kilometers per hour. It's making a delivery on both sides of the street every 10 centimeters. It travels and makes its journey in 40 minutes every day, and it delivers one package incorrectly every 3 years. That's the rate of fidelity of DNA copying. I'm just going to say it again, because I don't think your minds are blown enough. It's too easy to take it for granted. 500 kilometers per hour, delivery every 10 centimeters, both sides of the street. We're not even talking about how lame it is, because when you're delivering on that side, you got to go in that direction. You know, it's a mess, okay? But I'm not even talking about that part. Every 10 centimeters, you make a delivery, and the journey every day is over in 40 minutes, and you make one mistake every 3 years. That is the rate of errors in DNA replication. So this little graph is meant to illustrate the error rates. And you know, you might ask, why do I have three copies of E. coli? That's something that I mentioned on the first day. I personally am deeply obsessed with the question of, do different methods come to the same results when you make a measurement? If they don't, it doesn't matter whether your paper was in a fancy journal or not. If people don't agree with each other to a factor of 100, then there's a problem in the field. So this is just to give you a sense of the discrepancies, if you want. But note, this is the error rate that I was just talking about of replication. You can see translation has an error rate of like 1 in 10,000. That means 1 out of every 10,000 amino acids is installed incorrectly. So let's try to make a simple estimate of the error rate based on the textbook picture, the most naive first picture that we learn about translation. So I want to invent a sort of toy model of translation in which there's a world in which there are only two kinds of amino acids, which I'm going to call H and P, H for hydrophobic and P for polar. I love this picture from the Alberts book, which basically is kind of an old school idea about thinking of protein folding as being dictated by sequestering the hydrophobic residues. So here's the picture. If I have only two species of amino acids, then the translation process can be mediated by two tRNAs, which I've labeled here by red and blue. And what I want you to note is to just remember that the equilibrium picture of translation is that the codon-anticodon recognition is based on base pairing, hydrogen bonds, and the wrong versus the right pairing is basically getting maybe one or two hydrogen bonds incorrectly. So we can use, last week I told you about the law of Boltzmann, we can use that law to compute the error rate that comes out of hydrogen bonds. And what you'll find is a very modest error rate. In other words, it's a very high error rate, 1 in 100. That's what you will find if you use the simplest, most naive picture of equilibrium discrimination. So in the in the early 70s, Jacques Ninio and John Hopfield both came to the idea, as best I can tell, independently of what we now call kinetic proofreading. It's a really, really interesting, deep idea of what I would call defiance. It's another example where energy is spent in order to achieve an end which you would not get in the absence of out-of-equilibrium driving. These are really cool papers. I'd recommend that you take a look at them if you have a chance. I think I'm going to skip this. Let me try to give you a version of how to think about this kinetic proofreading idea, okay? So I have an enzyme shown here in green. And this enzyme is considering two molecules, a red one and a blue one. The job of the enzyme is to chop the molecule. And it wants to chop the blue one, and if it chops the red one, it's made a mistake. And the question is, how does it discriminate between these two scenarios? So the first step is just ordinary equilibrium binding, shown at the top with the dissociation constant kr shown at the bottom with a dissociation constant kw for wrong and right. So what I'm trying to say is that the receptor is just sitting there. It's just sitting there, and red molecules are binding to it, and blue molecules are binding to it. And what's the ratio going to be? The ratio is going to be given by their relative binding energies, or the ratio of the so-called KDs. But then a really interesting thing happens. What happens is that there is irreversible work done. And I represent that here by pushing a piston. Why do I do that? Because this piston, when I push it in like this, what I've done is I've changed the concentration of that yellow molecule. And that brings us back to the subject of last week's talk, which was the MWC model. And I just say again, it's really fun. My buddy, Professor C, is right there. That's the C of MWC. So what we've done is we've changed the concentration of the yellow molecule. And that actually alters the conformational state and puts the enzyme into a competent state. It's now competent to do the cutting reaction. When it's in the inactive state, squarish looking thing, it can't cut the molecule. It has to be activated. So I represent that with this piston. And now what I want you to imagine is that I reset the stopwatch. What do I mean by that? Because the moment I do this work, the system now has two choices, either cut the molecule or the molecule falls off. Those are the two choices. That's the only two things that can happen. Let me show you that. Right here. So this blue molecule is bound. The green molecule here is now competent to do its enzymatic action, and one of two eventualities can occur. Either the blue guy falls off with a rate constant K off, or it's cut with a rate constant R. And I can figure out the probability of the cutting, which is given by, I'll call it P cut, and that's equal to R over R plus K off. So that's the probability that I will do the cut. And so now, here's the gist of it all. The red guy, the wrong guy, has a larger off rate. When I say off rate, it means it's less happy being bound to the green guy, so it's more likely to fall off in a given time interval. So if I wait this long, then the blue guy is more likely to still be there. Uri Alon has a really fun way of describing this, and since we're in France, it's fun to describe. Here it is. He wants us to imagine going to, let's say, the Musée d'Orsay. And there's a room, we're going to invent a room that has Picasso paintings in it. And so what's going to happen is that there's a normal KD, there's a normal rate at which all of us, as we're walking through the museum, some of us will wander into the Picasso room, and then we'll wander back out. That's the KD. For those of us that like Picasso, maybe we stay in the room. For those of us that don't, we leave. But now there's a trick. After a little while, we shut the doors. So now everybody is locked in the room, and then we open the exit door. Those that like Picasso stay. Those that don't are like, whoa, they opened the doors, I'm out of here. And the point is that that leads to another level of discrimination and a second chance to proofread the affinities of the audience for the paintings. You see that? I mean, I don't know. I don't know how people feel about analogies and whether or not they're sensible or not. There's a really fun thing in the Feynman lectures where he's talking about quantum mechanics, and he says, you know, another time also when he's talking about my topic for next week, which is fields, the fantasy of fields. And he says, look, you can talk about field lines and you can make up stories and stuff, but at the end of the day, what really works here is the math. Like, that's the thing, is the math of Maxwell's equations or Schrödinger's equation. And so at any rate, maybe at the end of the day, the Picasso analogy holds or doesn't hold. Maybe you like it, maybe you don't like it. I like it because I think analogies are fun. They make me think hard about, well, okay, where does that analogy break down and where is it right, and so on. So So the point is, just to make really, really make the point, the off rate of the wrong guy is higher than the off rate of the right guy. And so there's a second chance to discriminate. And that leads to a probability of the correct versus the incorrect, which now basically goes as the square of the equilibrium constants. Again, the details of this are not hyper important. And if you really want to understand it, like deeply, I think you've got to read the papers and you got to do calculations yourself. And what I would say, you know, I don't know if everybody in the room will agree with me, but I would say that even to this day, that this topic remains subtle and that even the professionals in the field are still debating and arguing with each other about it. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say today. So what was the topic? What was the big idea that I wanted to get across? I wanted to, first of all, just amuse you with this whole sort of fruitless discussion of what's the secret of life, whether we're talking about science or about what are you going to do with yourself in your life. I don't know. Who knows is the answer. But I hope, you know, I think it is amusing. And probably the best way, at least for me, to think about it is there's something that really troubles me as somebody who's supposedly a professor. And that is, I'm always chastened by the autobiography of Einstein, who, when he was at ETH in Zurich, he was very unhappy as a student. It was 1895. And they did not teach Maxwell's equations to him. That's 30 years after Maxwell had written down the equations for the electromagnetic field. Einstein said the most fascinating subject at the time that I was a student was Maxwell's theory. But they didn't teach it. That'd be like being in 1955 and not teaching quantum mechanics. Very weird to my mind. Very weird. Quite off. Why do I bring it up? Because I always worry. I really worry. I have all these brilliant 18-year-olds at Caltech. I'm the first thing they're going to see when they do freshman physics and freshman biology, where I'm one of the first people. How am I failing them? So I think that framing this discussion of what is the secret of life is fun. It's a good way for me to say to myself, what should a kid learn about biology? For sure, for me, you know, again, I don't know if anybody would agree, I don't personally think it's that interesting for me to tell them about 5' to 3'. I think the moment they order some primers, they will discover for themselves that there's a directionality and they'll waste some money and then they'll be frustrated and they'll understand. So anyway, I like this idea of the non-equilibrium aspects of living systems. To me, it's a partnership between physics and biology that must be made, and both physics and biology are less than they could be in the absence of that partnership. You know, I gave you various examples. I could have gone into any and all of these, but I kind of focused on the top two on the left. And I just want to say this again, and I'm sure I will end with this again next week, which is just to say, you know, in the spirit of the pleasure of being able to do science, you know, within science, I realize, you know, we have our specialities, we have our polarizations, our strong opinions, and whatever. But, you know, when you contrast that with the mindset of some person, you know, in the middle of the US that's concerned that evolution isn't true, that maybe the Earth is, people didn't go to the moon, and, you know, stuff like that. I don't know. The entirety of science is a thing, I think, that's very beautiful. And so physics and biology are giving each other these wonderful gifts, and I think that the questions that I broached today are good examples of that. So what I'm going to do next week, I'll finish up by talking about the world as a continuum, and that'll be my last theme. And here, too, I offer it in a way as a provocation because I want to question the idea that the only valid way to understand mechanism is in biology is through molecules. I basically think that's quite wrong-headed, and so I'd like to make that pitch to all of you, and with that, I'm happy to take questions.